Welcome to Two Bees in a Podcast, brought to you by the Honeybee Research and Extension Laboratory at the University of Florida's Institute of Food and Agricultural Sciences. It is our goal to advance the understanding of honeybees and beekeeping, grow the beekeeping community, and improve the health of honeybees everywhere. In this podcast, you'll hear research updates, beekeeping management practices discussed, and advice on beekeeping from our resident experts, beekeepers, scientists, and other program guests. Join us for today's program, and thank you for listening to Two Bees in a Podcast. Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of Two Bees in a Podcast. Today, Amy and I are joined by Dr. Sameer Kadri, who's a postdoctoral research scholar from the Department of Animal Production and Preventative Veterinary Medicine in the College of Veterinary Medicine and Animal Science at Sao Paulo State University in Brazil. And we're doubly fortunate because he is also a visiting scholar here in the University of Florida Honeybee Research and Extension Laboratory. Sameer, thank you so much for joining us on Two Bees in a Podcast.
So thank you so much, Amy and James, for inviting me for this talk. Yeah, I'm really excited to talk a little bit about Brazilian honeybees and how works the beekeeping in Brazil and about some research.
Well, great, Sameer. That's truly the benefit of having you on is, but you are both a commercial beekeeper and a bee researcher in Brazil. And so we're going to touch on all of your work and your experience with the industry in Brazil, as well as some of the research that you're doing now. So that's the first question that I'd love to ask you is, how did you end up becoming a beekeeper and how did you end up becoming a bee scientist?
So yeah, it's a long story about it. I started being a beekeeper a long time ago, maybe 15 years ago, because my parents lives in a farm, countryside, Sao Paulo State. And in this farm, we usually find some wild swarms there. So when I was young, I tried to catch these swarms, but I didn't get a good success on it. After that, I entered in the animal science undergrad course, and during the undergrad course, I'm really interested in how to keep bees, how to produce honey during all the undergrad course. So then I start doing some training in a beekeeping area during my undergrad course. And after that, I start my own company doing consultancies in all the state for beekeepers. And during all this period, I developed a small production of meat. So it is necessary to have a good honey to produce meat. And then what I did, I started buying honey from beekeepers, but it's not easy buy a good honey in Sao Paulo State with a really good quality beekeepers, because all the times the beekeeper says, oh, you're making meat, probably I can sell you a pre-fermented honey to produce your meat. So this is what happened. So I started my own production, just thinking about the meat during my master. After I finished this process of consultancies, I started my master in beekeeping. And then during my master and my PhD in all beekeeping, I start my own apiaries to produce my own honey, to have like a really good quality honey to produce the meat that I want to produce. So, and during all this master, PhD, I was increasing the number of hives that I have. And now I'm producing honey, not just for my meat, but to sell honey in jars, in buckets, in barrels. So I grow inside the beekeeping more for honey production.
You know what, Sameer? I don't think we've ever had a guest who told us that they were interested in producing mead, and that's what made them become a beekeeper. So that's always really fun to hear, you know, all the background stories of how people get into bees. Now, let me ask you this. How many colonies do you have in Brazil?
So nowadays I have around 500 to 600 colonies in Brazil, in almost 20 apiaries around my city. So I live in Botucatu City. It's a city countryside, Sao Paulo State. It's around 250 kilometers from Sao Paulo City. So in the area that I have all these apiaries, It is a huge area that produces a lot of eucalyptus. It's the biggest eucalyptus crop area that you can find in Brazil. And almost this eucalyptus, it's cropped for cellulose production to export. This is why in this area that I have all these apiaries that I'm producing my honey, we have a huge production of honey from many beekeepers. We have three different associations that are inside all this area. And my city and all the cities that it is around of my city was mentioned in the last year, the cities that produces more honey in Brazil. So, yep.
That's amazing. So, you know, I'm excited to talk a little bit more about commercial beekeeping in Brazil and what that involves. And, you know, I know Brazil is a huge country, but in general, can you kind of describe the nature of the commercial beekeeping industry and about the beekeepers in Brazil? So you already mentioned a little bit about the associations and how your area produces a lot of honey. You know, do you know how many beekeepers are in Brazil, and what do the commercial beekeepers primarily do as far as the industry goes?
So in Brazil, we have, it's really hard to know how many beekeepers we have nowadays, because we have a confederation that organizes it, but we have not a lot of beekeepers as professional beekeepers. This is something really hard to know, but we have how much honey that we produced in the last year. So we produced in the last year around 50,000 tons of honey, and we have around 3 million beehives in Brazil. So with these numbers, you can see that you don't have a really developed beekeeping in Brazil with a high honey production. So we have around 16 to 17 kilos of honey produced by each hive in a year. So basically nowadays, we don't have really developed beekeepers in Brazil in general. But what is going on? These small beekeepers, it's trying to improve the production. We are like doing a lot of like doing starting doing new breeding programs, and these beekeepers trying to increase the production to get more profit from beekeeping. So we are having a transition between the small beekeepers to medium or large beekeepers to be more profitable, the beekeeping in Brazil, to get more money. So this is what is going on. And then how works, basically, I will talk about my area, the area that I live in, São Paulo State. So how works a person that wants to become a beekeeper in São Paulo State? So basically, if you want to become a beekeeper, a professional beekeeper that wants to receive money from your production, you need to be inside association. And what is the benefits to be inside association in Brazil, in São Paulo State? These associations make contracts with big companies that have a large farms, and then this with this contract, we are allowed to put some apiaries inside these farms. So I'm in inside three associations in my state. So this contract basically is made between association and industries that produces eucalyptus, cane sugar, and orange. And then these industries allow us to put inside our apiaries, and then we usually pay, depends the company amount of honey for each beehive that we put inside these farms, or amount of money. And almost the times, these companies gives back this money and this honey for the association. And the association uses these monies to invest in the infrastructure for beekeepers. So buying new equipment for honey extraction, buying some equipment to make easier sell honeys in jars for people inside cities. So this is what happens in Brazil in beekeeping nowadays.
So Samir, you spoke quite a bit about honey production. So I'm curious, you know, Amy and I, are, of course, are based here in the U.S. And in the U.S., honey production is obviously very important, but pollination is a really big business for beekeepers here. I'm curious, in Brazil, how do beekeepers make money? Is honey their primary production? Is Do they do any pollination? Are they paid for it? Do they do value-added hive products, you know, beeswax, propolis? Do they sell packages and queens? What's the principal sources of income for beekeepers in Brazil?
In Brazil, the principal source of beekeeper income is honey. But we have a really specific regions that produces kinds of products from bees. So São Paulo state produces more honey. Minas Gerais state produces more propolis. We have a lot of beekeepers specialized in green propolis for exportation. In some parts of North Brazil, we can find some specialized beekeepers that produces pollen. So we have these cocos areas that produces different kinds of products from beehives in Brazil. But about pollination, in Brazil, we don't have this huge market as here is in US. So nowadays, beekeepers pays to the farmers to put bees inside the crops to pollinate crops. It's completely different as here, as the farmers pays beekeepers to come and put bees inside for pollination. So this is why some new startups in Brazil, it's growing nowadays, trying to make this good link between farmers and beekeepers, and trying to match farmers and beekeepers that wants to put bees inside farms, and farmers that wants the bees pollination, and trying to make income for beekeepers when the beekeepers do this type of service for the farmers. So
Samir, I'm going to change topics a little bit. And, you know, I just got back from Apimondia in Santiago, Chile, and there, you know, there are so many beekeepers from all around the world, right? And you meet someone new, you start talking to them about bees. It's very easy to talk about bees for hours and hours. But something that everybody starts to discuss are some of the challenges that they face. So some of the problems that are going on, some of the issues. And so in general, can you describe some of the challenges that beekeepers face in Brazil?
So I think nowadays the biggest problem that I have in my area, that I have my apiaries, it is the use of some agrochemicals from farmers. So we are losing a lot of swarms by farmers that don't use chemicals correctly. And this is a really big problem that we have in Brazil. And another problem that I'm having in my area, because I'm in an area that's for honey production. So almost our honey from Brazil we export, and sometimes the price of the honey that we receive from people that buys for us to exportation, it is too low and can't pay what we spend to produce this honey. So this is another really important topic that needs to be discussed in Brazil, and all the times in conferences in the associations we discuss it, that you should improve the honey consumption from Brazilians. So we will sell our honey in the internal market, and then we can get a better price than export in barriers for other countries.
Do you have disease and pest pressures like a lot of other folks do? For example, how bad is the varroa? And I know for example, that small hive beetles have been found in Brazil relatively recently. Are those issues that beekeepers and their colonies face?
In Brazil, we have fecalized honeybees. So our fecalized honeybees, it's really, really defensive and have a really good hygienic behavior. So when I came here to US and a beekeeper asked me, what is the difference between the beekeeping here and beekeeping in Brazil? I basically said that it's another world of beekeeping. We have a completely different bees from the bees that you can find here in US. We have varroa mites, we have beetles in our colonies, but seems that these varroa mites and these beetles don't make so bad for the bees as here. So these bees, these are kinds of the bees that we have in Brazil, all the time trying to control the infestation of varroa and the beetles. So this type of disease is not a really big problem for us in Brazil, but we have this pest in our colonies, and it's easy to find varroa and beetles, but we just have problems with beetles and varroas when we have a really weak colony and swarms in the apiary. So basically, we don't do any type of control for varroa or beetles and for other type of disease that you can find in the swarms. American fowl brood, European fowl brood, some types of viruses was related in some studies that people did in Brazil in some colonies, but it's not a big deal, it's not a big problem for us. And people don't care about it nowadays. But what's going on? After this problem that we're having now about farmers using a lot of agrochemicals, we are getting all the times really like intoxicated swarms, intoxicated colonies that have a small size colony. And then when we get like intoxicated colony, sometimes it's really, it's easy to find some disease on these colonies. So what is going on? People, it's starting to take care about some types of disease and tracking some types of disease, because this is more related with weak colonies that get intoxicated from some agrochemicals.
Well, given all that information, where do you think the future of beekeeping in Brazil is heading?
I think this is a good question, because future of beekeeping in Brazil, I think the principal point that we will need to take care it is try to make a good relation between beekeepers and farmers in Brazil, more linked to agrochemicals usage in the farmers. So this is one point that all the times big companies that produces different types of crops goes to associations, gives talk, and try to make a good relation between beekeepers. So these farms is trying to track in where is the apiaries around the farms, and just to take care if the airplanes goes to pulverize agrochemicals near these apiaries to not have a lot of dead bees around. Yeah, this is the point that Brazilians beekeepers it's taking care and make a good relation between farmers and beekeepers should don't lose these agrochemicals.
Yeah, definitely, Samir. We are also doing the same here in the United States, you know, having to connect beekeepers with growers and just make sure that everybody is on the same page and educating growers and also educating beekeepers as well. So, as Jamie mentioned earlier, you are a visiting scholar with us at the lab here in Florida. Can you discuss your focus of your research? And you had mentioned earlier that you did your master's and PhD in bees, and you're now in your postdoc. So can you talk to us about the research that you're conducting?
So yes, I'm here as a visiting scholar. So what I'm doing in Brazil, it's a research that to try to find what gives the difference between honey production and afukaras and honeybees. What is usually you see in the field, it is you have like inside the same apiary swarms, like colonies that produces not a lot of honey, and swarms that produces a lot of honey. And these swarms, we can't send any clinical signs of disease, and all the bees is together in the same apiary. So what I was studying, what is the difference in the genetics of these bees that makes the honey production goes up or goes down? So what I did during my PhD, I worked with some beehives inside the university, doing the same management for honey production, all the beehives with the same age of queens, doing a blossom in the same apiary, all the same conditions. So I collect the queens from all these hives, and then I sequence the DNA from these queens, And then I found a search for some mutations that can be correlated with this trait of honey production and other behavior traits, for example, defense behavior, hygienic behavior, because the beekeepers wants to have hive with low defense behavior, high hygienic behavior, and high honey production in Brazil. This is what everyone wants. After that, I entered in my postdoc, and then I try to validate these mutations in other commercial beekeeping population. So I did another field experiment with a larger field experiment with more than 200 hives, monitoring the honey production of these hives during three different blossoms, with all in the same type of management, but in different apiaries, different areas, different blossoms. After that, I collect bees from these hives, and then I track if I find the same mutations that I found in the previous study. So after that, I asked myself, if I have some disease in my hives that I can't see any sign, any clinical signs, and then this is what is making my beehive don't producing so much honey as the other group. After that, I searched in the scientific areas, good researchers that works with this type of disease diagnosis using molecular biology techniques. And I found Dr. Ellis. So I made a contact to Dr. Umberto, and Umberto made a contact with Dr. Ellis. And I came here with some samples from Brazil, test if these bees that produces low honey or high honey have some disease that I can't find any clinical signs, but I can find doing molecular assays, the DNA or the RNA from viruses, bacteria, or fungi. And after get these results, I want to correlate this disease to the honey production and defense behavior and hygienic behavior change.
Well, Samir, that's interesting research. We're happy to have you here. And I listened to you talk about beekeeping in Brazil and all the work that you're doing. You're really doing a lot. I mean, you're managing 500 to 600 colonies. You have a successful honey production and mead business. On top of that, you're studying diseases and pests in selected lines of bees that you personally selected for high or low honey production. But I do want to shift gears just a little bit about, after listening to everything you've discussed, you in Brazil is home to other types of honeybees, principally stingless bees, many species of stingless bees. And you tell me that you also keep stingless bees. Can you tell us just a little bit about your experience keeping stingless bees and making honey with stingless bees?
Oh, that's in Brazil, you can find a lot of different stingless bees. It's really like, it's completely different as beekeeping. In Portuguese, it says meliponicultura. It's a person that works with melipona and trigonas in general. So what I do in Brazil, because he maintains all these apiaries with all these number of hives, basically I get swarms in traps to introduce in my apiaries when I lose some. Colonies inside, but sometimes I get some melipona or trigona swarms in my traps. For this trap is made of for Apis mellifera, but sometimes I get these melipona and trigonas inside, and then I move all these melipona and trigona swarms for specific boxes that are used in Brazil to keep it inside. And depends the time of the year, I have more or less stingless bees in my own house inside the city. This is like something that it's really cool in Brazil, because we have African honeybees, and African honeybees, we have some laws that it's forbidden in urban areas. But stingless bees, as the name says, don't have stings, and it's not so defense as the African honeybees. You're allowed to have inside urban areas. So I have all these stingless bees in my house inside the city, and sometimes it's not like, it's more for hobby that I have these bees. It's not profitable for me. But sometimes I'm harvest honey from these stingless bees. We have a huge difference between honey production inside the different species that you can find in Brazil. Some hives from Trigonas, you can harvest almost 100 grams of honey during a year. But some species of Meliponas, you can harvest 10 kilos in a year. So they have this huge difference. And it's completely different how it is inside a nest of stingless bees compared to Apis mellifera bees. In Apis mellifera bees, you have all the honeycombs in vertical, but in stingless bees, you have all the honeycombs in horizontal. This is talking about brood. And when you talk about the honey, stingless bees have some small cups inside the hive. Then to harvest the honey, you need to suck this honey with syringes or a vacuum pumps. Completely different in Apis mellifera that you can have, like you have the frames inside that you move and centrifuge and come back with discount. So it's another role in the bees area.
You know, I think this series is not going to be good for me because all I want to do is go and visit and see. I just want to work stingless bees. I would love to see the honey harvesting process. You know, I'm sure I could find a video online somewhere, but I want to see it in person. But it makes me really excited to hear you talking about beekeeping in Brazil. All right, Samir. So the last question that I have for you, you discuss eucalyptus honey and how that is your primary production. Can you just the last question that I have for you is what other types of honeys are very popular in Brazil?
Yeah, depends the area. Brazil is huge, so you can find a lot of types of honey in Brazil. Talking about the São Paulo state, we have principally four in my area, four different honeys. So we have eucalyptus honey, orange honey, wild honey that we harvest in the end of the year in December, January, in the summer period. And another type of specific wild honey, it is cipolva. This one we harvest during the winter. So cipolva, it's a really light honey, wild honey, that you harvest in the end of the year. Depends the area because we have like large forests with a lot of different types of trees inside. You have like light honey and dark honey. Eucalyptus in general, it's a dark honey, and orange, it's a light honey too. So we have more production for eucalyptus honey and wild honey, more brown honey, and light honey, it's more hard to produce and have a higher price when you sell it. But in other states, you can find a lot of different types of honey. You can find in Espírito Santo honey from coffee crops that people produces, the Brazilian pepper in some areas of Brazil, a lot of beekeeper produces it. In South Brazil, you can find uva Japão. It's a Japanese grape, the name of this kind of blossom. It is a light honey with a good price, which is produced in the South Brazil. So we have a really specific productions in really different areas in Brazil.
All of these honeys sound amazing. I just want to try some of all of them. I'm curious, Samir, as my last question, is the Amazon area a good place to produce honey? People always think about the plant biodiversity in the Amazon rainforest. And I'm curious, is it a very good area to produce honey?
A really good question. all the time people ask me this question. In Amazon forest, it's really hard to keep bees in production because we have a huge humidity in Amazon forest. So it's really hard to keep bees, Africanized bees, in areas that have like a huge humidity. So what people usually have inside Amazon forest, it is stingless bees production. So we have a lot of Melipona that produces a lot of honey, and you can produce this honey inside the forest. And sometimes the government keeps these meliponicultores, these beekeepers that works with Melipona, inside these forests to preserve the forest. And these people lives inside the forest can get money from the forest without destroying the forest. And this Melipona produces a lot of honey and can sell with a higher price when you compare for honey produced by optimally for organized honeybees in Brazil.
That's fascinating, Samir. I really appreciate that you sharing that. Hey, thank you so much for joining us on this episode. It really sounds fascinating about all the work that you do, as well as being a beekeeper. I'm not sure how you're able to wear both hats and do so much work as a scientist and beekeeper. But thanks again for sharing your experiences with our listeners.
Thank you so much for inviting me for this amazing podcast.
So I really like this series, Jamie, of just speaking to beekeepers, you know, talking about the different types of beekeeping. It's always fun to hear. It's not fun, but I like hearing challenges that beekeepers have in different countries, because sometimes they're exactly what I would have expected them to be. And then other times, you know, I hear things and I'm like, oh, wow, you know, I didn't really consider that before. So it was nice to have Samir on discussing, you know, just his experience as a beekeeper and also a researcher.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, first of all, Brazil is a big country, right? So there's so much diverse beekeeping, probably even within that country. And then to compare what we do here in the U.S. or what folks do all over the place, it's just very different. There's always some common threads when you speak to beekeepers elsewhere. I mean, he mentioned pesticides as a potential issue for him and some industry related issues and honey prices. All of those are common. But there were some surprises. I mean, when I asked him a follow-up on, well, what are the big issues with bees? And he mentioned prices and pesticides. Okay, that's fine. But then I said, well, what about varroa? What about small-eyed beetles? And he said, well, we've got African bees. So what about those things? And so it's really interesting to hear about some of the things we struggle with so much that beekeepers in other countries don't have to deal with, because they just have a different strain of bee. And it's really neat to hear his experience in Brazil and him be able to share that with our listeners.
I also had no idea that he kept stingless bees. So that was fun that you brought that up. I didn't know that he had kept stingless bees. And so, you know, what has your experience been working with stingless bees?
So it's funny, we actually talked about that this morning at breakfast. I will say to our listeners, our lab meets once a week for breakfast meeting. Today we're recording this podcast. We happened to meet this morning before the podcast, and I was talking to Samir about keeping stingless bees in Brazil, because I was in Brazil, I don't know, a decade or so ago, and where I visited University of Sao Paulo, they had in Ribeirão Preto, which is a city away from Sao Paulo, they have a bee lab there, and half of the folks study honeybees and the other half study stingless bees. And while I was there, it's my introduction to stingless bees. I'd never seen them before. And they have multiple species of stingless bees there at their research apiary. And if you know anything about stingless bees, they don't sting, right? That's in their name, but they do defend themselves. And they all defend themselves slightly differently. So I would go and knock on a box of one species to see how it would attack me. And then once I got those bees off of me, I'd go and knock on a box of the next species and see how it would attack me. And some of them pull your hair. Some of them try to go up your nose and in your ear. Some of them try to bite you. Some of them spit propolis at you. Some of them even have a type of acid product that they spit at you. And so I was going down, letting them attack me. And in Thailand, beekeepers have stingless bees there. There's just stingless bees all over the place in the tropics. And generally speaking, their diversity is amazing. Their nest structure is amazing. They don't really keep them in the sense that there's much management. It's more so they just provide a house for them, and the bees thrive in that little box, and then they'll go through and collect the honey. One of the things that's unique about stingless bee honey, and it's usually, wherever I am in the world trying it, it's usually has a very high moisture content, so it can be quite prone to fermentation. But otherwise, it's just fascinating, and there's so many species of stingless bees. It's many lifetimes of study if one were interested in researching these critters.
Geez, you know, I thought stingless bees. When you say that, it makes me think, oh, really cute bee that's not going to sting me. But I don't know how I feel about getting acid spit at your face.
They're not defenseless, but I knew that it wasn't going to be as painful as a sting. So I'm like, well, let's just see what these things have. So I would literally squat right in front of a hive, knock on the box, and with a bare face, you know, with no veil, I just wait to see what they would do. And yeah,
And then you that put your human experience. Face back on.
Yeah, exactly. And then I put my human face back on. But I would go right down the line just doing that, just over and over and over to see how each one would attack me. I don't know why I chose my face. I probably, in hindsight, I should have used my hand, but I figured that I'd appreciate it most if they were swarming around my head.
You've got to go big or go home, I guess.
That's right. I leaned into that one for sure.
It's everybody's favorite game show, Stump the Chump.
Hello, and welcome back to the question and answer segment. So, Jamie, the first question. So, here at the Honeybee Lab in Gainesville, we have an observation hive room, and when people walk in, it's noticeably a different color, and the light in there is the color red. And so the first question that we have is that this person heard that bees cannot see the color red. And so they're asking, so what do the bees see? And is this true?
So bees cannot see the color red. How they see red is they see it as the color black. So the simplest explanation, and again, I'm not a vision expert, but the simplest explanation is that humans see further into the red spectrum than do bees, and bees see further into the ultraviolet spectrum than do humans. And so we overlap a little bit in the middle and can see some common colors, but red they translate as black, while we can see it as red. UV patterns they see all over the place, whereas we see nothing at all. And from the UV perspective, again, the question was, what do bees see when they look at the color red? Now I'm going to go to the opposite end of the spectrum. A lot of flowers that bees visit that to us look yellow or red or whatever, if you look at them through the UV perspective, there will often be incredible patterns on petals that we are unable to see. We might translate that whole petal as yellow or the whole petal as red. Mm-hmm. But given that bees can see into the UV spectrum, they can see things on flowers and in the environment we are unable to see. Now, back to the other end of the spectrum, the red end of the spectrum, just like what you said, the reason a lot of scientists observe observation hives under red light is because it minimizes the disturbance to bees. The whole point of an observation hive is to study the behavior of bees, right? You're doing something to the bees and then recording behavior. And if you've ever had an observation hive in a dark room and flipped on the regular light, you'll hear the hum of that observation hive change. It's a very noticeable change. They see the light, the bees all run up to the top of the observation hive. It really changes what they do. And so when you're using observation hives for purposes of research or answering experimental questions, you want to keep that behavior of the bees as normal as possible. And so a lot of those studies are done under red light. Now, make no mistake, the red light that we're creating in our own observation hive room, it's not true red. Bees are able to see some light in that, but it's not nearly as disturbing to their behavior as is regular light. So the shortest answer to the question is, what do they see instead of red? They see the color black.
This is going to take me back to my scuba diving world, but you know, with the UV light, and the deeper you get in water, the color red is the first to go away. And so, yeah, it's kind of interesting. I mean, I don't know if we have a lot of spearfishers who are listening on, but when you're scuba diving and spearfishing, you know, you're down at like 100 feet and you shoot a fish and the blood comes out as green. It's pretty crazy to see. It really messes with your mind.
That is kind of crazy. Maybe bees would do well that low in the water, since they don't. I'm just kidding.
Maybe we are in a beekeeping podcast, not a scuba diving podcast. So we'll move on to the next question now. Okay, so the second question we have: how does a pollen basket cling to a honeybee? You know, we see those pictures of those pollen baskets on the back of a bee's on their hind legs, and how do they stay on there? How the heck also do bees fly with those baskets on them?
Yeah, so it's a very This question makes me chuckle. And again, I don't, it's hard to know sometimes when you have just the basic question, like what was the individual's understanding of the system when asking the question. So I giggle because when I was a child, I heard the word pollen basket. Well, basket to me is like this thing in which you can carry stuff. Mm-hmm. So I always thought that bees, honeybees specifically, on their hind legs had this this like layer of skin that they could open and stuff into it, like a built-in bag, you know,
like a kangaroo.
Like a kangaroo. Imagine that. Yeah, just on the back. I was about to go with, is it hamsters that can stuff into their teeth?
Yeah.
I was thinking something like that, but a kangaroo is another good example. So imagine having kind of like a kangaroo pouch on your hind leg. That's what I thought it was. I thought the bee would pull open this kind of sheath of bee skin and pack pollen into it. Well, that's obviously not what happens. And so to answer this question, the basket itself is not clinging to the bee. It is the bee. It's part of the bee. And so it's kind of hard to describe this over a podcast, but I'll do my best. And make sure folks out there Google pollen basket and then look at the images and you'll see what I'm talking about. But imagine I'm doing this now to kind of be able to explain it. I've got my hand before me resting on my desk such that I'm able to look at my forearm. Okay, so I'm imagining this forearm is the hind leg of a bee. Imagine down one side of my forearm, I've got these stiff, long hairs that are growing. And on the other side of my forearm, I've got these stiff, long hairs that are growing. And the hairs on both sides are pointing at one another. All right, that is what the pollen basket is. Essentially, it's a stiff row of hairs on either side of the leg, the back leg of a bee. So when that bee collects pollen, she moistens it with nectar and she packs it between these stiff row of hairs. And so maybe another way to paint this picture is put the palms of your hands together. Now, open your hands up, but point the fingertips towards one another. It's almost like you've got your hands together about to catch a football. Well, imagine holding a volleyball with your hands, with the butts of your hands touching one another, almost where you wear your watch, holding a volleyball like that. That's how bees are holding a pollen ball on their hind legs. It's almost like two sets of cupped hands collectively grabbing that volleyball, one hand on both sides of the volleyball. And that's the imagery here. So the hairs are part of the bee. There's nothing that could fall off in that context. And this stiff row of hairs, almost like fingers, are holding on to this nectar moistened pollen ball on the hind leg while the bee flies back to the nest.
Interesting. I'm still looking at my hands right now, like, okay.
I know I was struggling with that when I'm sitting here. How do I describe this? but again, the idea is like where you would wear your watch, the very bottom of your hands, make sure you touch the bottom of your hands and then open your hands as wide as they can be. And that's kind of like, imagine trying to hold a ball with your hands touched at the bottom. That's kind of how a pollen basket functions.
Interesting. All right. So for the third question, what does the word eusocial mean? I've heard that before, but I have no idea what it means.
Okay. The word, first of all, for those of you who are not familiar with it, is spelled E-U-social. It's all one word, E-U-S-O-C-I-A-L. So the prefix U, E-U, means truly. So eusocial means truly social. And so, well, that's probably not very helpful at all. Eusocial means social.
Yeah, thank you.
So let me explain it this way. There are 20,000 species of bees on the planet. And those bees, those species of bees, range in natural history from solitary, meaning they live completely alone, to eusocial, like honeybees. And there are three characteristics that scientists use to categorize levels of sociality. Those three characteristics are cooperative brood care. That means individuals are taking care of other individuals' young. They are collectively working to raise the young. Number two, there is a reproductive division of labor. That means somebody reproduces and somebody else doesn't. And number three, there's an overlap of generations. In other words, the queen and her offspring live together. So if you are solitary, you have zero of those three traits. If you are eusocial, you have all three. So honeybees are eusocial. They're cooperative brood care. There's lots of workers working in the nest to take care of the offspring that don't belong to them. There's a reproductive division of labor. There is a queen producing offspring, and the workers are not. And there's an overlap of generation. The queen mother is hanging out with her daughters. And so all three traits of sociality are met in honeybees. So they are eusocial. Bumblebees are also eusocial. They have all three of those characteristics. Solitary bees would have none of those. They wouldn't work cooperatively to rear young. They don't have a reproductive division of labor. There's no overlap of generations. Now, it's important to know that since there's three characteristics, and you can have zero of those, and you can have three of those, there's also a group in the middle that has some combination thereof. So the three levels of sociality are solitary, we talked about it, pre-social, and eusocial. So eusocial is what we just had explained. So pre-social is the one in the middle that varies in the number of those three traits that they have. Maybe they've only got cooperative brood care. Maybe they've got cooperative brood care and a reproductive division of labor. So those level of pre-social, there's subsocial and there's parasocial. And within parasocial, there's communal, quasi-social, and semi-social. So there's these stages of sociality represented amongst the species of bees. But eusocial would be the one that has all three of those traits.
What would be an example of pre-social?
A pre-social bee. Let me scroll down. Pre-social has actually four categories, a subsocial category and a parasocial category that itself is to split further up. So let me give you an example of what that means. Communal bees have zero of three met. Quasi-social bees have one of those three met, and semi-social bees have two of those three met. And so within those groups, communal bees, for example, some halicted bees or sweat bees, they don't do any of those three things, but they might share a nest. So for example, there may be one hole that goes into a ground and multiple bees go down that hole and then excavate their own chambers off of that central hole. They don't rear one another's young. They don't hang around for the young to emerge, but they're using the same nest site. So it would be like communal. Moving up from that, quasi-social means that you might have multiple reproducing members of the same generation sharing a nest. And some examples of this would be like orchid bees. There are some where you get multiple members sharing the same nest. And from there, you could even take the next step into semi-social, where you have members cooperating in brood care. You might even have a reproductive division of labor. And again, some sweat bees will fit those. And so it's really remarkable. One of the most remarkable families of all bees is Halictidae, the sweat bees, because sweat bees have all levels of sociality represented amongst its species. Whereas the 10 species of honeybees, for example, they're all eusocial. There are no solitary honeybees, but sweat bees have all three levels. And so there's this whole branch of research in entomology where folks are studying the development of sociality. They're looking at different bees that occur in these different categories. It's really kind of remarkable. It's really, really interesting to see.
Yeah, that's amazing. I mean, even just, you know, the eusocial aspect of honeybees, that's complicated enough. I can't imagine getting into, you know, if honeybees were different socials.
I tell you, Amy, one of the most amazing things about this is there's people who's studying this, and what they're looking at, for example, is they're looking for genes that are responsible for the development of sociality. So the idea is that being solitary is the earliest way these bees would have existed. And so there would have been changes in them, you know, over time that ultimately led there's benefits to living in social structures opposed to solitary structures. And so there are laboratories looking for those genetic changes that happen as bees transition from solitary to social, and trying to figure out, you know, what are the social genes, what things are necessary before critters will congregate and start taking care of one another's offspring.
Very cool. All right. So those were our three questions for today. We hope you all enjoyed our questions. Don't forget to send us an email or send us a message on one of our social media pages.
Thank you for listening to Two Bees in a Podcast. For more information and resources on today's episode, check out the Honeybee Research Lab website at ufhoneybee.com. If you have questions you want answered on air, email them to us at honeybee@ifas.ufl.edu or message us on social media at UF Honeybee Lab on Instagram, Facebook, and Twitter. This episode was hosted by Jamie Ellis and Amy Vu. This podcast is produced and edited by Amy Vu and Sarah Sowers. Thanks for listening, and see you next week.